Hello, everyone. This is Carl Jacob in New York City.
This is Aaron Brown in Northern Minnesota.
And you're listening to Power in the Wilderness. Today's episode is brought to you by the Siegel Family, honoring filmmaker Bill Siegel and the work of Free History. Today's episode is also brought to you by someone we got to know while researching Power in the Wilderness, Victor Leon Befera.
If that name sounds familiar, he is named for his father, Delmo Befera's dear friend, Victor Leon Power.
Thank you, Siegel family, and thank you, Vic, for your generous support of today's episode. Power in the Wilderness, Episode 7.
The other thing that I grabbed from the museum, because I was looking for stuff that wasn't Vic Power, but was like about the time period and could be related. And I found a set of memoirs written by Mrs. George Boudreau. It looks like her first name was Elvira. She lived in Hibbing. She came there as a child in 1900. But she says, "And then Victor Power was elected mayor. We were for him, although too young to vote, but on the bandwagon we were for sure." I mean, so even as people who were too young to vote, they had opinions about Vic Power, and enough so that they liked him. So she says, and then we got married and lived on McKinley Street, and so they're in North Hibbing for a little while. "My husband was firing for the Oliver Mining Company for $52 a month, and the years 1913 and 1914 were hard ones. The mining company closed down in the fall and did not open until the spring. So we sure had a good mayor. He said he was going to put every man to work, even with how much it cost the village. By now, Alice was building up, so he gave all the men work digging sewers. And there were engineers, firemen, businessmen, men of all trades digging sewers for $2.25 a day. And it sure was a godsend for all of us in those days." And she goes on a little bit more about like their work schedule for the mine, and they would work in the summer and then get laid off and then work in the summer. They bought some land in Alice. So they were living in North Hibbing. They bought some land in Alice. And then in 1915, we built a two-room shack on our land. There was no one near us, only two houses on our block. Mr. Randall Neamy moved an old store building from the original Hibbing, and that was there, and us. We had big tree stumps about 3 feet wide in our land, and later we had them pulled out and used them for wood. And now I was in the same boat as I was as a child, with no water, no sewers, but we did have lights. We got water from a pump in front of the Alice School." So she's talking about having been a kid in North Hibbing before it was developed and improved, you know, all those civic improvements that we'd been talking about, and then having to move to Alice and start over with none of those things again.
That was our friend Erica again at the Historical Society. Aaron, why don't we tell people what we're doing here?
We're trying to understand what things are like for people other than Victor Power and the mines and the merchants. That there's a majority of Hibbing that are just working people, mostly immigrants, who are scraping by on a lot less than Victor Power or his friends or the mining companies have to deal with. They're really subsistence living.
Which we outline and touch on particularly in episodes 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And the whole time that we've been following Vic's storyline now through the rest of these episodes, that hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
I mean, lives have gotten nominally better as a result of the work that Vic is doing, finding people employment when they're not in the mines, but
the drinking water is safe to drink, and the town is cleaner. There's more to do.
And it's getting paved. You know, all the things that we've talked about gradually lifting people up. But at the end of the day, the workers are still making a non-livable wage. Lots of people living in boarding houses. People can't afford to even rent their own whole houses. I mean, there's also not a lot of houses available because of the massive number of people who have moved to the city. So that, combined with this underlying goal of the mines to want to move Hibbing off of the iron-rich earth that it's sitting on top of, is creating within the discourse, the chatter, the thinking, the feeling of the people, this idea of, I don't know, feeling like something's got to give. And it's around this time that this woman writes in this diary, 1915, 1916. And she's talking about moving south, moving to this new land that Victor Power had annexed to make a part of Hibbing, because there was affordable land there. And even though they're trading the comforts of Hibbing and the paved streets and the lights and all that,
flush toilets,
sewage, they're trading down in lifestyle, but they're trading up in status because now they're able to start purchasing their own land. And we start seeing the newer immigrants, the ones who haven't been established, moving south and starting to form this larger Hibbing. Around this time, there is also a fire. The Oliver Mining Company had just purchased a building in Hibbing. And shortly after the purchase of that building, it catches fire. And it catches fire in a way that it spread very quickly, and had Victor Power's fire department not been on top of it and put that fire out quickly, it would have easily threatened the entire town and taken a lot of old Hibbing out, which of course would have been really good to accelerate this move to South Hibbing. And in the newspapers of the time, that speculation is very apparent.
Yeah, all you got to know is that Pine Street is mostly wooden buildings, and they're all right next to each other, just like an old saloon. You just picture a saloon row. Most of them are saloons, but there's hotels and stores. And when one building goes, there's a real good chance it's going to take a few more with it. And in fact, a big enough fire could burn the whole north end of town, which, as you said, is what the Oliver wants. Well, there is open speculation in the newspapers after this particular fire, because where the fire starts, it doesn't look accidental. Looks like someone put a cigar in a bin of oily rags in a way that would be beyond careless, but perhaps intentional. So there's open speculation by Claude Atkinson in the Mesaba Orr that, you know, maybe somebody, if not the mining company, somebody that they know might have an interest in a fire. And the fact that they're even thinking this way just shows how paranoid, perhaps rightly so, the town is about this moment in history, because they've invested their lives in building this town, these merchants, these people, but it's on borrowed time and space. The ore underneath it is extremely valuable, and all the people have is the surface rights. And if you don't know anything about mining, the mineral rights versus surface rights almost always goes towards the mineral rights. That's where the power is. So when something like this happens, it's a real risk.
Now, the other thing that's going on among the chaos of episode 6, which is something we didn't talk too much about then, but we'll briefly talk about now, is one of the tools in U.S. Steel's Swiss Army knife that they're using against Victor Power is the enforcement of not the entire treaty, but a single clause in a treaty with the Indians that was made in the area that Hibbing rests. And that clause particularly addresses the sale of alcoholic beverages to American Indians, Native Americans. And funny how they didn't really enforce the rest of this treaty.
Yeah.
But really just chose this one clause to enforce at a time when one of the largest part of Hibbing's economy, at this time, 75 bars. Is that how many it was? 75?
It had dropped after the saloon rules that Vic installed. It was down to like 47.
Okay. So,
but still plenty of bars for a small town.
Yeah, 47 bars in a very small area. And Vic, as we know, is a drinker of alcohol, a lover of alcohol, as are many of the members of Hibbing at large. And there is an example to be made of Hibbing on a political scale for the idea of nationwide prohibition, which is what starts to happen. As you know, U.S. Steel is a very big company. They have a lot of powerful friends and people who have agendas that they want to get pushed through various local, state, and federal level legislators. So what ends up happening, to make a long story short, is that federal agents from the Bureau of Indian Affairs comes to Hibbing and starts shutting down bars and effectively tries to enforce prohibition in Hibbing because of this treaty. And as you can imagine, this is a chaotic scene and very disruptive to everything. But what ends up happening is, in the same way the people of Hibbing are banding together to fight things that they feel are oppressing them, those same networks quickly organize and start operating a underground network of booze makers, which we touched on a little bit in an earlier episode. But this is the time when it really starts to take hold. Large parts of the Italian community are really good at this because their families already make wine. And the most successful bar owners continue to operate their bars, but essentially they aren't called speakeasies yet. What are they called?
They're blind pigs.
Blind pigs. And this is the scene that's being set. The town starts moving south a little bit. There's this pre-prohibition prohibition and articles being written about Victor Power and this drunken city as far as, where was it, Ohio?
Yeah, Westerville, Ohio.
On the front page of a newspaper in Westerville, Ohio, there was an article about Hibbing, Minnesota as an example of why prohibition is needed in the United States.
Yeah, den of sin, basically. One of the things about this booze issue that is tricky for Vic is that it adds to the degree of difficulty of the political work he's doing. Everybody likes making money, and that's a lot of what unites his people against the mines, because they feel the mines is getting stuff that should be theirs. That's a pretty basic human impulse. It's easy to unite people. Booze doesn't unite people the same way. Some people love it, and some people are okay with it, and some people think it's the devil. And so he has to try to appease different sides of an issue with the booze issue. Now, he personally uses alcohol. Some of his closest political allies are saloon keepers who sell alcohol. So he's got to keep them happy in business for them to keep supporting him. But he's also got to get votes from people who don't like booze, which means he can't have his hands on it too much. So when the federal government announces that it's going to enforce these old treaties, and what they are is a series of treaties with the Chippewa people from the 19th century. And it was the treaties that took their land away, basically, but were largely ignored in all other facets until they realized they could use the alcohol issue as a test case for prohibition. So they announced the intention to enforce the treaties, and Vic is the lawyer for the effort to stop them. And while they hold it off for several months, he's unsuccessful in stopping them. They do have the authority to do this.
There was a great example of him getting a restraining order against the federal agent.
Yeah.
It delayed the time for him to come into the city, but he ultimately beat the restraining order in court and was able to come and enforce. But that's the kind of cheeky, fun things that Vic was doing.
Yeah. He was buying time for his friends. And by the way, friends who understood that this day was going to come and were making arrangements. I mean, the price of booze went up in this period, and people were stockpiling, storing it, setting up their own operations. It was widely understood that a new era, a new economic era of bootlegging was coming, and many were planning for this as a business decision. Among them, a lot of the saloon keepers. Other saloon keepers, the ones who were not willing to break the law, were actually facing destitution and were actually looking at the end of their business careers. In fact, there's a rather prominent likely suicide among Victor Power's friends of a barkeeper who, at this moment, he ends his life. And so this is a very dramatic time. Are you going to break bad and become a blind pigger and a bootlegger? Or are you going to try to find another job? Are you going to go work in the mines for a fraction of what you were making at the bar? A lot of hard decisions for Vic's friends in this period. And he's trying to keep them all together because he's fighting the war with the mining companies.
Now he's got this added workload of needing to go to court to help his friends become legally shielded as much as he's able to do so from persecution of a bootlegging, or as in one case, it was called moonshining, where he got one of his friends off by reading the definition of moonshine from the dictionary, which read, making liquor by the light of the moon, under which circumstance his client did not do because he was distilling the liquor inside of a house. So that's how that one got won.
Yeah. Well, he was poking holes in the early, very porous laws that weren't very strong, weren't very clear. And he was using every legal trick in the book. And he was the best out of the newspapers I've read at getting people out of the off the rap for bootlegging, blind pigging, saloon owners.
And prostitution, which was in a lot of cases, or some cases, the same clients.
They were often related, yeah.
Yeah.
But he could use technicalities. Yeah, quite often, we would call them that today, and get people out of these charges often straight up acquitted without a plea deal or anything or any kind of admission of guilt. And he was the best at this. And so he was helping his friends. He was also making a good amount of money because it was quickly realized into the beginning of this era, what they called the Indian lid, into Prohibition, which comes a couple years later. The business interests of bootlegging figure out that if you have a good lawyer, like a Victor Power, you can sustain fines as part of your business operations. You might even lose a car once in a while to impound, but all part of the cost of doing business, because the business was really good. And so Victor Power is in on the architecture of this. He's not necessarily directing it. He's not necessarily involved. We don't know what his conversations with his clients are like. But we do know that this infrastructure of, you know, booze running becomes part of the day-to-day life of people across the Iron Range, and Hibbing being the largest town. And so it is absolutely part of the culture and the political world as well. In fact, we can trace origins of, you know, alcohol of this era to this place and time.
Most famously is the Mondavi family.
Right.
As you may know from the California wine empire, Robert Mondavi being the most famous name of them all. Well, Caesar Mondavi, Robert's father, was born in Hibbing and started his wine empire in Hibbing in this period in 1915.
Right.
And the thing that Caesar discovered was some land in California where I think at first he was just purchasing grapes from.
Yeah, he was going to California and buying grapes in great lots. You know, he would buy a couple train cars full of grapes and he would bring them back to Minnesota and sell them at a nice markup to all of the Italian and Austrian families that would make their own wine. Great little business venture.
Well, when 1915 comes around,
yeah,
that business venture explodes. Because now they need to make all of the wine that everyone is consuming and Hibbing.
Right.
And there's, I was going to tell the great story of the train coming in at night, but maybe you remember the details better than I do, Aaron.
Well, only that, like I said, these grapes were on train cars and they'd come in, you know, whenever they could get the special train to come up. It was a freight operation. And the grapes are not illegal, but everybody knows what you do with the grapes. Nobody's having grape salad out of these things. You know, they're pressing and making wine out of these grapes in every basement across Hibbing. And so for personal use, you could say that's fine. But what was happening is, you know, families were realizing that with the value of wine being greatly enhanced by the lack of ability to buy it, if you made enough wine for your family to have with meals and sacramental wine and whatever else you needed it for, you could make maybe say twice as much without much extra effort. And you could sell that wine to the guy down the street who was buying because he was distributing. And you could actually pad your family's income in a way that made them a lot more comfortable. A lot of families were getting in on this. It wasn't that there was one Al Capone-like figure who ran the whole place. It was that virtually everybody in some places, in certain neighborhoods, was involved. And it was so widespread that it was really difficult for authorities to pin down.
I feel like this is one of the reasons why there is a sustained conspiracy of silence about this period, because it was so widely accepted as an okay thing to do because everyone was so destitute and because everyone was just feeling overly oppressed by first the mining company and then the federal government, so that when people who were living through this era are asked to talk about it later, they'd rather not because it was complicated. Everyone was doing it, but did that make it okay or did that make it not okay? Who knows? I don't want to be judged for what I had to do to help my family survive, so I'm just not going to talk about any of it. I think that's a very plausible reason why this conspiracy of silence exists.
You do a lot of searches of associates of Victor Power, various people, Paul Morris among them, and you find that, boy, they were arrested a lot during this period. And while they didn't do serious time or anything like that, might have paid fines, it was common for people who had a still or who had, it was just part of life. And in some ways you could look at like modern day prohibition, if you look at the drug trade and things like that, there's communities where people are just in the business.
Yeah, whole families.
It's part of the fabric of how you get by. And this was the case then, only it was wine. There's another dynamic at play here. The immigrants coming into town are overwhelmingly Catholic. The later immigrant groups, the Italians and the Slovenians and the Croatians, are Catholic. And they use wine as part of a cultural practice far more. The people who run the mines are mostly Protestant, and of a particular brand of Protestantism that really believes in prohibition and temperance. And as a result, you have the powerful saying, no booze for you. The powerless, the immigrants, the workers, are like, well, we have wine. Wine is part of life. Wine is what you have with your dinner. Wine is what you have for the sacraments. It's part of what we do. And it's okay to have some wine. It's in the Bible, even. Well, now you have a multifaceted conflict going on between cultures. And it's one of these issues that divides a community that, when Victor Power is first elected, it's a united front, the people against the mines for the good of the community. Well, now you have this issue that's dividing the community along different lines, and the mines are indeed on one side, largely in favor of temperance. Victor Power is left on the other side trying to help his friends who are, you know, keep in mind, he's tight with the Italian community. He's tight with the Croatian community. He's got friends who represent him in those communities. It's part of his operation, his political operation. So he's got a problem when they have to go underground. He, by association and in practice, is underground with them.
I can only imagine that the mines being on the side of temperance in this particular instance, combined with the fact that they had just starved the city of money and put them through these sanctions, played a unifying role in what comes next. Mm-hmm. I would like to make a quick aside about Atkinson, who is the publisher of the Masaba Oar, who is in support of the temperance movement, but was so upset about what was going on and the collusion between the mining companies and the temperance enforcers that he was actually against what they were doing, despite the fact that he personally supported temperance.
Yeah, Atkinson's an interesting figure here because I get the feeling sometimes he had a checkered history with alcohol in his past and had reformed himself somewhat. And he likes the idea of not having saloons in town. But what the mines are doing, and particularly what some of the enforcement agents are doing, entering homes, doing raids, because it's that immigrant community, well, that's also where the unions are. And so if you bust in and check for stills, you can also check for Industrial Workers of the World literature, for a red flag, or something else that would key you that this is a house that is not, you know, on the good side of the mining companies. So these kinds of things are happening, and it's all layered together. It's not just about the booze.
The thing that comes next is a strike. All of the strike breakers who were brought in when the strike happened in, what was it, 1907?
07 was the first major range-wide strike, and it was based out of Hibbing.
And new immigrants were being brought in by the droves or being enticed to move to Hibbing to work in the mines when the people, the Finns and the Italians who had established roots and been working in the mines for a while now got sick of working conditions and low wages. And then these new communities came in and they started breaking the strike lines and working in the mines. So there was the second wave of miners that now have settled in to life in Hibbing and are now also getting upset about the working conditions and the lack of livable wages that it came to a head. So the old guard and the new guard are now both pissed. Vic had just got done whooping the mines, as the local papers would state. And I think that combined with the now prohibition, temperance, Indian lid stuff, combined with everything else going on, that it was just time. It was time for the workers to rise up. And that's what happened.
There were economic reasons too. World War I by now is well underway. The U.S. Steel Corporation's started to make money off the war. lots of money, and they're picking up business, and they really need labor. They can't even get enough of it because there's more mines to open than they have people to open them. And so there's demand. So there's a lot of supply and demand going on here, too. The workers start to realize how important they are to the mines making money, and they look down at their paychecks, and they're getting $2 and change a day to make hundreds of millions of dollars for the corporation. And they're saying, well, this is what those old Finns were talking about when we got here. And maybe there's something we need to do. Across the country, the industrial workers of the world are organizing. Now, their main interest initially is to organize copper mines out on the West. But they realize they can't do that unless they get a hold of the mines in Michigan and Minnesota, where there's a lot of workers who kind of filter through the American labor system. They think, we'd really like to organize there.
Because they would be organizing against the same company.
Yeah. It's the same company, but also the IWW is a international union. They think of the union movement as one big union. That's literally their slogan. And they want one union for the whole world, and they want to control labor, you know, not control so much as empower labor to confront capital in a big global battle. Well, you can't do that unless you're in every little town where mining is happening. And Hibbing and the range is an area where, you know, unions have struggled to gain foothold because U.S. Steel is so virulently anti-union. And so they start sending some organizers, and they're about ready to maybe make some recommendations about a strike movement. But what happens is, spontaneously, because of conditions getting worse and worse, the miners start going out on strike before they're even ready. And so it's actually a guy named Joe Greeny. He gets his paycheck for the week. And he's not known as a particularly radical guy. He's just a miner. And he looks down at his check and he says, this is not enough for my family to live. And he starts yelling and screaming in line at the getting his pay. And he says, that's enough. I'm not working anymore. Guys start agreeing with him. They walk off the job and they start walking out to the other mines and saying, that's it. We're done. Well, I mentioned that it's spontaneous because the IWW wasn't totally ready yet to organize. So they had to organize quick, and they do. But that's one of the reasons why the strike initially kind of takes a haphazard approach, a slapdash approach, because they weren't super organized. It was like a wildfire. In fact, Gary Kaunanen, who we talked to, wrote a book called Flames of Discontent about the strike of 1916 on the Mesabi. He talks about how the conditions were all there. It was like dry, like ready for a fire. And a fire was about to break out because it was starting to smoke and it was catching the tinder all laying all around in the working conditions and the lives of the people who work on the Mesabi Range. So this is just kind of, it rears up, it takes over, and it comes through the spring and summer. It rears up in a very big way. And all of a sudden, as many as 10,000 miners are out on strike. The opinions vary because the mines all continue operation or try to. And so you don't have to go on strike. They'll take anybody who can work if you're willing to cross a picket line. But within a couple of weeks, it becomes really a very tense situation at every mine in every town. And a miner has to decide, okay, I get $2 and some cents a day. That's not enough to live on, but it's enough to buy some bread today. And am I going to go to work, cross a picket line against some of my colleagues and fellow countrymen who might beat the crap out of me if I do, who might throw rocks through my windows if I do, and get that $2 and change, $3 maybe, but then I'm just here in my life barely getting by just like I am now? Or do I go on strike where we might encounter the Oliver Police Force, a private army, essentially, of plainclothes detectives, many of whom are not really law enforcement types so much as oftentimes convicts, bruisers from the bar, gamblers, bouncers are common to be hired by these organizations, big guys who stop fights or who end fights, more likely.
There was literally a pipeline from a local jail to the Oliver
Correct.
Army.
Yeah. Yes. So these guys are law enforcement the way, you know, Godzilla is law enforcement.
Yeah, or law enforcement the way that hiring a gang to be your law enforcement would be.
Right. So they're not above, if they can find striking workers in small groups, they're not above going around and assaulting them out in the dark of the night, All kinds of things happen. People get killed for reasons that aren't clear. It's dicey like this. So every miner has a personal choice. Not only what side am I going to be on, but how am I going to protect myself no matter which side I choose? There's a really compelling story of a guy. He runs the pumps at one of the mines. Now, if you don't know mining, you got to know that the pumps are what keep the water out of the pits. And they're the reason you can mine. Pumps are life for a mine. Without a pump, underground mines flood, pits fill with water. And the guy who runs the pump is visited by the union or the organizers who say, you gotta sabotage the pump. Destroy the pump, destroy the mine, we'll stop them. And he's like, but if I destroy the pump, I'm gonna go to jail. And they said, but you know, we can help you, you can get away with it, whatever. But he's like, they're gonna know. And they're like, you better do it, because if you go to work and just guard the pump like you normally do and keep it running, you know, you'll be siding with the mines and that won't be good for you. And so he's thinking like, what are they going to do to me? Then he goes to work and the guys at the mine are telling him, if you talk to those union guys, it won't be good for you. And ultimately, this particular man decides to report the union to the police, thinking that he'll follow the law. That was his thinking. He didn't want to run afoul of the law. So he does what the newspapers and others say is the right thing. But what is the right thing? And that's a moral and ethical choice that all of these people are making in this moment. And suffice it to say, there is ore production, but it's being slowed down by the strike.
During World War I. Which is not a good thing.
The U.S. is not in the war yet, so it's not yet a patriotic thing, but it's certainly a capitalistic annoyance because there's a chance to make money and the mines aren't making enough of it by their liking. And so this union issue is getting to be a real problem.
It's even more of a problem for Vic, mm-hmm. because Vic has people kind of on both sides at this point, and his options are to either take sides or to just let things play out and try to keep things civil, which is what he ends up doing.
Right.
And to his credit, he uses the city's police force to prevent the Oliver thugs from kicking people's asses in the streets of Hibbing.
Right.
And there's sort of a red line that's drawn between the jurisdiction of Hibbing and the jurisdiction of Oliver, and the private Oliver army's not really allowed to do their business in Hibbing, which you can argue is good for the people of Hibbing because these thugs aren't going around intimidating people through the streets of Hibbing. But it's also a confusing message because there are all these people that supported Vic and voted for him who are now seeing that he's not siding with them in the same way he sided with them during the tax fight and the other fights leading up to the tax fight. So it's confusing.
He does several things that you could call pro-union. He agrees to let the striking workers hold a parade in the street. He gives them a permit that they request. So he lets them have a parade. He agrees to keep the Oliver police out of Hibbing. Many range towns don't do that. In fact, most of them allow the mining company police to patrol the streets. And that's where a lot of the violence occurs. That's why a lot of the most violent things that happen in this strike occur in other towns on the Mesabi Range. Though one particularly violent episode did happen at Hibbing. And that was after this parade, a vigilante, one of these kind of guys who came in to help the mines out, he runs into a crowd of strikers who are in this parade at the end of the parade, right in front of City Hall, and he scuffles with them, and they scuffle back, and he pulls a knife and actually stabs a guy. And the anecdote, you know, that was kind of famous at the time, he runs up to Victor Power, who wasn't far from where it happened. He goes, "See, Vic, didn't I do good? Kind of like, look what I did to those, you know, socialists, those communists, you know." And Vic was like, "I gave those people a permit. There's supposed to be no violence in the streets." And so that guy came away disappointed because he thought he did a good thing. But that kind of shows the position Vic's in. You know, he's not a union guy per se in terms of the more radical industrial unions. He's not a socialist. He's a progressive.
The critics of Vic will point to that occurrence as a brazen shunning of the strikers. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you really distill it and break it down, you can really understand the very difficult position
yeah.
one would be in that circumstance.
Had Vic given a full-throated support of the IWW at this moment in history, his political career would have been over. He wouldn't be the mayor of Hibbing. It would be too difficult for him to stay in power. But had he done what mayors across the range tried to do and had historically done, which is try to break the unions and help the mines during strikes, he would have lost as well, because his voters were working people, and there were more of them every day. And so politically, the fact that Vic Power comes out of this period still with a political coalition is pretty remarkable, but it's only possible because he's a good politician, which means, unfortunately, if you know anything about politics, he doesn't take a strong stand at this very pivotal moment. He tries to protect both sides, to hear both sides, and frankly, just to keep the bulk of the violence out of his town.
It's worth mentioning briefly that during this whole time, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who is the famed communist organizer and speaker, makes a visit to Hibbing on behalf of the IWW and gives a speech while she's there.
Yes.
Flynn and Vic famously take a private car ride together.
Yeah, Vic shows her the mining properties and the locations, which, if you think about it, if he was really trying to stay out of trouble, he wouldn't go anywhere with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. And we can speculate about why he agreed to do this.
Well, I think it's just another... I mean, he didn't ultimately agree to represent the IWW, which Elizabeth Gurley Flynn requested of him, correct?
Well, no, so this is where it gets complicated because...
Oh, this is where it gets complicated,
he
right.
did agree to represent the IWW, but later faced accusations that he took their money, but he didn't work very hard on their behalf.
Right.
Then again, it was a tenuous situation. Hard to say. But whether that was related to this trip with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, we don't know. We just know that Elizabeth Gurley Flynn is a nationally, internationally, one of the major voices in labor at this time. And she gives these stirring speeches. And the reason Elizabeth Gurley Flynn comes to Hibbing to run the strike is because the previous organizers and leaders were all arrested on the charge of murder. Only they were charged for killing a man, or actually two men, in a town 50 miles away from where they were.
By Wabik.
Right.
It's a great story, and it's worth telling, I suppose, because it really sort of punctuates the end of the strike. Because the level of violence that happened in this event was too high for both sides. Three men were ultimately killed. Wasn't it three men?
Two. An Oliver policeman and a bystander were the ones killed.
Oh, okay. So
none of the... Yeah.
So here's the overview of what happens. During this period of time when Oliver's thugs weren't allowed into Hibbing to enforce their brutality against the strikers, the brutality was going on in neighboring towns, as we had mentioned. Bywabik was one of these neighboring towns. And in Bywabik, there was a boarding house that held... some men from Montenegro, right? Was it Montenegro?
I'd have to check that, but they were of the Austrian Empire, so they were referred to as Austrian, but they were Eastern Europeans, Montenegrins or perhaps Slovenians, but from that area.
And the cops go there. Now, when I say cops, I mean the private Oliver cops.
The sheriff's department had special deputies, which were essentially Oliver policemen in official disguise.
And what was the reason they were first called to go there?
Oh, I don't... It was there... They had a lead that somebody who had done something might be in there. They had some kind of supposed probable cause to search the premises under, you know, the guise of checking on something or looking for someone that they thought had done something.
Right.
And so they essentially raided the house, though. That's what this was a raid.
And what that lead didn't include was the fact that the men and women in that house had served in the Austrian military and were really good at defending themselves.
So
the raid goes wrong.
Yeah, these guys come in thinking they're going to intimidate some foreigners who are going to be scared of them. And they get in there. The first person to hit them is the woman who's holding a baby, but is stone cold fighting. And then these big guys come down the stairs and they're vets of the Austrian army. And so this goes south on these guys who had raided this house real quick. Well, they're armed. The gun is drawn.
It's questionable of who was armed or if both sides were armed or if there was a gun and it switched hands Those details are kind of unclear.
To this day, you hear different stories about how this played out. But guns were drawn, shots were fired, which I realize that's passive voice, but we only use that because the details are unclear. Did the workers get a hold of one of the guns in the scuffle? Was a police gun fired the opposite direction? Was there another gun entirely? Anyway, one of the deputies is killed. And as the shots are firing, a vendor out on the street.
Selling popcorn.
Yeah, soda pop or popcorn or just food items. He's just out there on the street in his little cart. He gets killed by the random bullet. So this is a simmering, bubbling boil of a strike has just suddenly burst into this moment of violence where people have gotten killed. And it changes the tone entirely of the strike because now this is potentially, according to the mines, a violent uprising.
And according to the workers, violent oppression.
But either way, both sides are now really going to ramp it up. And the solution, the sheriff's solution, is to not only arrest everybody in that house, except the baby, but it's to arrest as accomplices to the murder the leadership of the industrial workers of the world who are there organizing the strike at various places around the Iron Range. And those guys had escaped their own drama way on the West Range. Actually, this very day, Carlos Tresca has to leave Itasca County as fast as he can drive because he's being pursued in vehicles by armed vigilantes trying to stop him.
Carlos Tresca being one of the union organizers who's being blamed for these murders on this same day.
Yeah, and so he's... He's driving back and he gets to Hibbing, which is dead because everybody's heard about this murder or these murders now. And so everybody's like, stay in your house. Things are going to get bad. And so Carlos Tresca observes that Hibbing is a ghost town, which is unusual. And then he goes to Virginia where he's staying in a hotel there. And his hotel is raided. All of his colleagues in the IWW, his leadership colleagues, are all arrested. Because they killed a man. What do you mean we killed a man? We've just been driving all day. We haven't seen anybody. Like, nope. You're accomplice to the murder in Bowabic. And so they're all in jail in Duluth. The whole leadership.
So is Vic the one that represents them and gets them off then?
He's hired to represent them and supposedly does give them some kind of legal advice. He's not the one to represent them in court, however.
Hmm. Was his firm representing them in court?
No. They had to hire an additional firm. This is one of the lingering resentments by the labor community.
Hmm.
He was, in fact, in attendance at the hearings. He would attend the hearings and take notes. He was there in a professional capacity. But when they needed a courtroom lawyer, he declined, probably for political reasons. He did not want to be the face of what was happening. The charges were ludicrous.
But he did not decline. He did not decline the car ride with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, though, if you look at an old picture of her, she's a young New England Irish American woman.
Fixed type.
Right. She's so passionate. She would have been an engaging, enigmatic, just exciting person to be around. And Vic,
yeah,
you know, Vic probably was fascinated by her, I would expect. And in fact, she knew what she was doing when she went to towns like this. She knew that she had one power, which is her speech. She was a great orator, one of the best in the country. Her speeches are still studied. But she's also a woman in a time when women were not supposed to have these positions of authority. And she could also... You know, befuddle men in power. If she couldn't convince them to her cause, she would befuddle them. And I wouldn't be surprised if Vic wasn't at least a little befuddled by Elizabeth Gurley Flynn.
Shortly after this time, the strike comes to an end, not because of successful negotiations between the union and the mining company, but because the mining company acquiesces in advance of any negotiations because they need to get their operations underway again.
Well, they don't call it that, though.
They don't call it that, but that's effectively what happens because they end up raising the wages, right?
They do. So initially, it's called a victory for the mines because the union runs out of steam. They run out of money and steam. Their guys are in jail. It's trouble. Looks like the mine won a huge victory. But the mining company knows that the problems are still there. And so that following winter, they announce that they're going to raise the wages across the whole company, including on the range. And that essentially takes care of several of the complaints, the issues raised by the union, one of their demands. Not all, but many of the demands the mining companies agree to, but they don't agree to it as a result of the strike because they don't want to encourage strikes. But the strike works to a large degree because later they have to admit they don't want another strike next year. They can't afford it.
It's also around this time that Governor Hammond, the governor of Minnesota, who was friendly with Vic and was serving his last term as governor, suddenly dies. And at this time in state government, the governor and the lieutenant governor are elected separately. So in this case, Governor Hammond, who was a rare Democrat in power for the time, had a lieutenant governor, Governor Burnquist, who was what we might call an extreme right-wing Republican. If you read the ideologies of this guy, you would understand clearly what his vision for the world is. And it's not one that is ruled by the people, that's for sure.
Yeah, he's a conservative. There's two wings of the Republican Party, conservative and progressives, which are more economically liberal, still maybe socially conservative. But Burnquist is a right-winger. And kind of improbably becomes governor. He wasn't on anybody's list of the next Republican governor of Minnesota. But because he's lieutenant governor and Hammond dies, he gets food poisoning and dies in Louisiana. And so Burnquist becomes governor. This is significant for a couple reasons.
The first reason is that he hates Victor Power.
Well, right. Burnquist doesn't like Victor Power. And Burnquist realizes he's been given the gift of a lifetime to become governor. And he wants to stay being governor because it was never something that likely would have occurred otherwise. So who are his big opponents or rivals? Well, in the Republican Party, one of the candidates that everybody's been talking about is a mayor from Hibbing who improbably beat the mining companies in the tax fight, who has built a modern city in the middle of nowhere. And so Burnquist looks about his kingdom and says, I got a deal with Victor Power. And Victor Power knows he's got a problem with Burnquist.
And around this same time, or, you know, within a few months of this period, it is not only being speculated, but being organized that Vic is likely to run for governor. And the Democratic Party likes this idea so much, they try to compel him to run as a Democrat. He refuses. But what he does do is say he'll run as an independent now that Burnquist is in office, and the Democrats commit to not running a candidate as long as Vic runs as an independent against Burnquist, and even promise to back him as an independent candidate. Burnquist obviously sees this as a direct threat.
This is driven by the Federation of Labor, AFL, the Minnesota Federation of Labor. They want Power as governor, and they've been talking about it for a year.
Which is probably good to quickly mention here, the fact that the AFL is backing him might be one of the reasons why he was a little hesitant to represent those guys from the IWW.
Right, which is the radical union.
So this adds a more clear picture to the whole strike situation.
And throughout the strike, we didn't even get into this, Victor Power is skeptical of the IWW. He doesn't think that they're going to stick around long enough to actually help the miners. He wants the Federation of Labor to organize the miners in what he calls a respectable union, one that's locally driven and sticks around.
And he ended up being right, for the record.
He was right about that in a large sense, but the AFL also is too chicken to actually organize the union in the face of U.S. Steel. They don't want to spend their political capital too soon. So anyway, the AFL likes Vic Power, and they know that their Democrat, who they had nominated that year, was going to get his brains kicked by whoever the Republicans nominated. And so this idea is hatched. Victor Power is not a Democrat. He watched his dad, who was a Democrat, get his brains kicked in a number of elections. He knows Democrats don't get elected in this part of the country at this time, and he's a Republican, at least a progressive one. And so he flirts with running as an independent. The Democratic ticket is planning a rally in Hibbing, and it's reported in St. Paul that the talk is they're having the rally in Hibbing to announce that the Democratic Party was going to pull their nominee, who was going to willingly step aside so that they could support a true independent in this race. And I wonder who they could announce in Hibbing, Minnesota, as their independent choice for governor. It's widely understood that that candidate's going to be Victor Power.
So, in the face of this, remember when Vic first took office and there was an audit that the state examiner's office did that was arguably forced by U.S. Steel to happen because they wanted to shake up the new administration and and scare them into not raising the taxes. Well, that audit ended up finding nothing wrong with the books.
Nothing serious.
Nothing serious. Found one little thing that was not really tied to Vic's administration. It was actually in the previous administration. But that audit is still sitting on a shelf in the state examiner's office down in St. Paul. And even though it found no evidence of corruption on the part of Vic's administration, Governor Bernquist walks down to the office of Andy Fritz and says, "Hey, Andy, remember that Vic Power audit? I want you to dust that thing off, and I want you to bring him to court and make him defend it in front of a judge," which is a total asshole move on Bernquist's part, but also a genius move on Bernquist's part if you think about what the implications are to Vic, because he now has to remove himself from the campaign trail in order to fight this case.
Even before charges are filed, the Duluth News Tribune runs a story that was leaked to them, and it was leaked by Victor Power's opponents, whether it was Bernquist or U.S. Steel or all of the above. And the story is even worse than the charges end up being. The story is widespread corruption and graft. G-R-A-F-T, graft. Huge headline. Victor Power, Hibbing, graft in the Duluth News Tribune. And it is dropped just 2 or 3 days before this rally in which it's believed by some that Victor Power is going to emerge as a dark horse independent candidate for governor. And we can maybe give a little bit of credence to those rumors, because as soon as this headline is run in Duluth and it crosses the state wires, that rally is canceled. It does not occur.
Wah, wah.
Yep. So Victor Power now has to devote his whole professional resource toward defending himself and 16 other members of the Hibbing community. The 17 most prominent people in Hibbing, including the entire village council, including Vic, both publishers of the two largest newspapers, the Hibbing Daily Tribune and Mesaba Orr, who have supported Vic, leading merchants, the heads of the Power and Light and Building Commission, other prominent officials and political allies of Victor Power, anybody who did business, large business with the village, was indicted on one kind of corruption charge or another and would face each of them potential jail time if they were convicted.
We endearingly refer to this collection of court cases as the graft trials.
The graft trials. Yeah, and that they are 17 different things, but in fact, one very big thing. It is an attempt by enemies of Victor Power to get him. He certainly believes that he's being persecuted.
Well, he clearly is.
Well, obviously. But those who believe that his spending is extravagant and that his program is wrong for the future of Minnesota, so to speak, believe that this is where they're going to nail him down. They're going to show everybody what they've been talking about with Victor Power being rogue, Victor Power spending the people's money inappropriately. We're going to catch him on all this stuff. Look, it's in the form. And they point to the large stack of paper that nobody wants to read through because it's too dense and hard to understand. And in fact, the charges are old and rather thin. And that will be proved in court, but not before the damage is done.
We don't need to spend a lot of time on the graft trials, but let's just say that the first two cases go so well, which is the case of W.J. Ryder, Vic's head of the Water and Light Commission, the furniture man, famously in support of the aggressive spending and building that Vic started when he first took office. It goes so well in that Vic defends him so well, and it is so clear that the case is baseless, that by the time the second case comes around and also goes so well, which is Claude Atkinson, the publisher of the Mesaba Orr, the newspaper, that it seems that the judge just gets frustrated with Andy Fritz and decides that the rest of the cases are not really worth going through because this is clearly a baseless lawsuit.
What happens is each of those cases goes to jury, and the juries are very quick. They come right back and they say, nope, not guilty. And the It's such an embarrassment. Vic is flaying them. He is tearing them apart in front of not just the jury, but the public and the newspapers. And the newspapers are straining, the anti-Vic newspapers are straining to think of a way to describe this that doesn't make them look bad, and they're having a hard time of it. And the cases are just disastrous. And by the time Claude Atkinson is acquitted, and there's 15 more people left to try, including Vic, the state basically comes in and says, okay, boys, we're going home. They pull the charges. They realize that they led with the two they thought they could convict, and they went so badly, and so that the evidence was even thinner on the rest of them. And so as a result, the cases are dropped, which is a great victory for Vic Power and his friends in that they don't go to jail. But it definitely took a toll on Vic personally. It took every ounce of his effort to defend himself and his friends. I mean, if you look at his journals through this time, if you look at the newspapers, he worked constantly, round the clock, through the weekends. He's in the office on Saturdays. He's in the office on some Sundays working on these cases. And he's very effective, but it clearly took a toll on him personally, in his life and his health, but also politically and his career. Because in many ways, even though he so well defends his friends and himself, the taint, the effect of that initial charge still lingers around him the rest of his life, even though he's so successful in defending against it.
Yeah, and can you imagine all of the fights that he has had with big, powerful entities in the last 2 years, and just how exhausted he must be and just tired of it all? The man's got a lot of energy, but there's only so much the human body can take.
Right.
And the human spirit. It's clear that despite his winning of the Graff trials and then getting reelected in an unopposed election in 1917, that Vic is both riding high and feeling low. And it's this same time that America decides to get into World War I. And that's when things get really complicated.
Life is a book that we study. Some of its leaves bring a sigh. There it was written, my buddy, that we must pass, you and I.
Power in the Wilderness is produced by Aaron Brown and Carl Jacob, and edited by me, Carl Jacob.
The show is made possible in part by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
This episode is also made possible with support from the Siegel family, honoring filmmaker Bill Siegel and the work of Free History.
And a special thanks to Victor Leon Befera, who helped make this episode of Power in the Wilderness possible. Thanks, Vic.
Previous episodes of the show notes and photos of the people we talk about, and information about how you can become a supporter of Power in the Wilderness are all available on powerinthewilderness.com. And a very special thanks go out to all of you who are already our supporters. We'll see you guys next time on Power in the Wilderness.
When something went wrong, I went alone through the gray days, missing your smile and your tongue. Nights are long since you went away. I think about you all through the day, my buddy. Nobody, nobody quite.